Alaska has more than 100 state parks. That includes everything from picnic areas to marine parks and vast stretches of wilderness. The parks host more than 3 million visits each year. But how is the state park system handling all those visitors in an age of budget cuts? And what are park managers doing to make sure even the most remote corners of Alaska's vast park system are used? That's just ahead on Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. What's your plan for adventure this summer? Does it involve an Alaska state park? Alaska has the largest state park system in the nation, and it is likely one of the most diverse park systems in the country, too. Today on Talk of Alaska, just in time for the big holiday weekend that's coming up, we have two experts to talk about both the bright spots and the challenges confronting the state parks. Ethan Tyler is the director of the State Division of Parks and Recreation. Hi, Ethan.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. And Aaron Kirkland is a travel writer based in Anchorage who spends a lot of time in state parks. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, glad to be here.
All right, thanks to you both. And also for you out in Radioland, what adventure, big or small, are you planning this summer? What would you like to see more or less of in your state parks? This is your chance to ask the state parks director directly. So give us a call, 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-8255. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. So Ethan, let's start with you. Just set the scene for us. Describe just how vast Alaska's park system is.
Yeah, thanks. So, you know, my background is in the visitor industry, and I've traveled all around the world selling Alaska as a vacation destination for a lot of my career. And one of the number one things that we have to kind of educate people who are coming up here on is Alaska is huge. And so it makes sense then that Alaska's state park system is huge. And so just over 3 million acres, the largest state park system in the country. We also host the largest state park in the country, which is Wood-Tikchik State Park. As you mentioned, really diverse system. We have state marine parks. We have picnic areas. We have we have public use cabins. And campgrounds and boat launches. So it's a really diverse system, but it's one of the most amazing state park systems in the country. In my mind, a lot of these state parks would really qualify as national parks in any other place where the residual scenery wasn't quite the same. So it's a really unique and a really interesting park system, and it's waiting for you to get out and get into it, including Anchorage's own backyard, Chugach State Park. Just under 500,000 acres is the fourth largest state park in the country. So anytime I get together with my counterparts in other states, I walk in with great bragging rights for having one of the largest state park systems in the country, or the largest state park system in the country.
Absolutely. Do you have an idea of how visits compare between state parks in Alaska and national parks? Who wins?
We win.
Oh, okay.
The visitation, the type of visitation is quite a bit different. So national parks, you'll typically find a lot more like visitor center type infrastructure, where the state park system is a little bit more it's got a little bit more basic feel, where it's more just campgrounds and hiking trails and access points, as opposed to like big visitor and education centers.
Sure. What's the most popular state park?
The most popular state park, I'd say from a usage standpoint, it's Chugach State Park.
So close to the city.
Yeah, I mean, it's right at Anchorage's doorstep. Surprisingly, actually, down in Juneau, there are three public use cabins at Eagle Beach. And those have the highest occupancy rates of any of our public use cabins in the system. Mm. So, you know, those are utilized primarily by Juneau residents. So those are some of the more popular public use cabins. And Denali State Park, on the way to Denali National Park or between Denali National Park and Anchorage, gets a fair amount of use, and is that usage is certainly increasing as we've expanded some of our infrastructure and facilities there.
Do you have a favorite?
I love them all the same.
His children.
but I will say that I live in Girdwood, and so I primarily spend my time in Chugach State Park, which is right in my back door. I like to tell people that I keep an eye on the southern end of Chugach State Park. But so that's the one I utilize most. But I've been encouraged by my daughter to get out and see some different ones and to try some new areas that I haven't tried before. So no one favorite. I'm maybe the jury's still out on that. How's that?
All right, we'll let you up on that one. Which park is the least visited in the system, and why is that? Is it an access issue? Which one is it?
Yeah, I like to compare it actually to the national park system, where Wrangell-St. Elias National Park is the largest national park in the country, and also one of the least visited, and that's because of its remoteness. And so from the state park perspective, Wood-Tikchik State Park, which is out in the Bristol Bay area, is the largest state park in the country and also one of the most least visited state parks that we have. And that is primarily, it's really remote, and access to that is tricky, and it's expensive to get out there.
Sure. The state park system has several new huts or cabins for rent. Describe those for us.
Public use cabins are a pretty hot commodity. They're really basic. And they're pretty diverse in their locations. They're throughout the entire state park system. They don't have mattresses or
sure.
beds or anything like that. They're really basic. They have plywood bunks and tables and a little cooking area and a heat source. So if you're in a place where wood's readily available, they'll have a wood stove. If you're in a place where wood is not readily available, they'll have a kerosene stove, and you need to bring your own kerosene and that sort of thing.
Why is the state investing in these new cabins? What's the idea there? Is it a moneymaker?
Well, it's twofold. It's the demand for this type of infrastructure is insatiable. I think we all have the friends who set their alarm for 12:01, 7 months out from the weekend that they want mm-hmm. that cabin. And so they wake up at midnight, they stay up until midnight, and they get online and they book this cabin because they go really quickly. Great example, our Tonsina cabin, which is one of our new ones down in Seward, came online last week on Monday. Aaron wrote a piece in the Anchorage Daily News on Tuesday, and by Tuesday afternoon, that cabin was booked every single weekend through October.
Wow.
So one is demand, and I'm interested to hear Aaron's thought on what drives that demand. I have my own ideas, of course. And then the other one is, yes, they are moneymakers. They're very low maintenance. They are, they're like I said, they're diverse in their location, so some of them are roadside, so you can drive right to them. Some of them are short hikes, and some of them are quite remote. But there's something for everyone. And so a public use cabin, for what it costs us to build one, has a payoff time of between 3 to 5 years, depending on occupancy and rate.
All right. Well, thanks for that. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend, and today we're talking about Alaska State Parks because Memorial Weekend's coming up. It's kind of the kickoff to the whole glorious season of getting out there and experiencing the parks. My guests today are Ethan Taylor. He is the director of Ethan
okay.
Tyler. I should have left my glasses on. Ethan Tyler, director of the State Division of Parks and Recreation. And Aaron Kirkland, who is a travel writer based in Anchorage. And Aaron spends a lot of time in the state parks with her family. And Aaron, I want to get you in here now. We've been talking about the parks and the cabins. You spend a lot of time in these cabins with your family. What's the appeal?
You know, I think the state park cabins and any public use cabin offers a visitor a bit of Alaska's wildness with kind of a safety aspect. And I know when we travel with kids, our first thought, especially in Alaska, is gosh, are the bears going to be out? And how do we keep everybody warm and dry? So when you add a solid four walls and a roof and heat, for many people, that takes away their initial worry that they're going to be cold and wet or, you know, covered with snow in a tent. So for a lot of people, that is the easiest way for them to capture a little slice of Alaska wilderness in a very easy and accessible way.
Your online site, AK On The Go, features articles about traveling, especially with kids in Alaska. What do you hear from your readers about the cabins and what they appreciate about this system?
Our readers are absolutely 100% behind the public use cabins and campgrounds and camping and getting kids outdoors. There's, a very nationwide movement to, it sounds like reintroduce our kids to the outdoor spaces that, you know, lots of us grew up enjoying, and a little bit more of the independent play and a little bit more of understanding the steps toward growing up an outdoor kid. And so our readers are really wanting to have more information about Alaska's outdoor spaces. And it's really interesting that, you know, about half my readership is from people who are visiting Alaska from out of state, but the other half are Alaskans who feel like they want to know more about where they can go visit with their family, but they just don't have enough information. And Ethan really, you know, outlined for us just how large not just the state park system, but our entire state is. And I think we all become overwhelmed a little bit and tend to just gravitate toward our favorite places and don't branch out a little bit more. So that's really what I try to do, is get Alaskans to explore some different spots around Alaska.
I've thought in the past about every summer you should just plan out a different park to visit and just do that. Do you do something like that?
Actually, I do. What I usually do, I print out like an entire listing of campgrounds that we want to visit and places we've never been. And we always try to visit at least two or three or more places that we've never explored before. And so, you know, I tell my son all the time, we get to live here, so why not take advantage of the different places instead of going to the same spots? Now, those same spots are very comfortable and welcoming, and we love them for reason, you know, intrinsic reasons, but we get to be here in this amazing place that people save up their money their entire life to visit for a week, so let's take advantage of that.
This is Talk of Alaska, and you can join our conversation today on parks if you have a question or a comment. You can call us statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us talk@alaskapublic.org. We're going to go to the phones in a moment, but Aaron, Ethan was talking about the Tuncena, the newer cabin, and you were recently there. Tell us about that.
So the great thing about the Tuncena cabin is that it's accessible in two different ways. You can hike out there from Lowell Point just outside of Seward, so it's about 2 miles, right, Ethan?
Yep.
Yeah, really easy hike. You don't have to worry about the tide coming in because it takes you through the upland forest, and it's quite lovely. Or you can take a water taxi, which is the route we eventually ended up going to get there. And the cabin, it's brand new. It's located on this nice little knoll just above the beach. And the beach at Tuncena is enormous. So just the idea of being able to sit on the front porch of Tuncena Cabin while your kids and everybody else are just running around out on this beach is pretty amazing. And it's far enough out of town that you feel like you've really gotten somewhere. But it's not so far that, you know, on Sunday afternoon when you need to hike out, it's, you know, you're out of there in an hour and a half. So very simple, as Ethan was saying, there's nothing fancy about it. But again, you have warmth, you have a place to sleep, and you've got a roof over your head. And it's just fantastic.
Was it snowing when you were on your way down?
So it was kind of a rough weekend.
The text messages that I was getting from Aaron that weekend were pretty amusing.
You owe me, buddy. So it our spring, as we all know, has been lingering a little long. So it was snowing on our way down there. And it was snowing sideways because the wind was so high. And so what we ended up doing ultimately is actually overnighting in Seward one night, and then we were able to get out the next day. But it was cold and miserable. But again, we were able to go into this cabin, dry out, warm up, and cook some great food. And we had a great time.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to go to the phones. Greg is in Anchorage. Hi, Greg.
Hey. Hey, I had a question about trail use policy. As far as, there's increasing use of these electric bikes you see all over town. And I was wondering if the park's policies have evolved on that or changed.
Good question. Wow, right out of the gate, we're gonna test my knowledge on our regulations and how we've evolved on this one. What off the top of my head, I'm going to say that we have evolved our regulations to prohibit electric bikes on our trails in the parks that do allow bikes.
Okay.
All right.
Very good. Good to know. Thank you.
Yep. You bet. Thanks.
Thanks for the call, Greg. So, Ethan, how do you set fees for the cabins? We've been talking about these awesome cabins. Aaron just told us about the great Tonsina cabin. How do you set fees for those, and are they changing? Are they increasing?
Yeah, it's a good question. And historically, the fees for cabins have been set by the different regions. And so they're, in my mind, right now, they're a little bit siloed. And so what you may pay $50 for a cabin out of Fairbanks, that's a really popular cabin, and you may pay $85 or $90 for that same cabin in South Central or even Southeast. And so what my goal, I've been in the position just under a year, and my goal for this next year is to add a little more consistency to that pricing. And so yes, the lower priced cabins that are akin to some of the higher priced cabins, those prices will probably go up over the next year. Again, to put some consistency in the pricing. What I would really like to get to, though, is something that's kind of a almost like a hotel model where you have a little bit more dynamic pricing. So some of the most popular months, it's a little bit more expensive. And then in some of the more off-season months, it's a little bit less expensive. And my goal in that type of thinking is that it raises some revenue, which is needed, of course. But in the off-season, it could potentially encourage more Alaskans to utilize those resources that are available to them and maybe a little bit more available during those off-season months.
Sure, especially for people that maybe can't afford to stay during the peak season that we see in a lot of settings vacation-wise, where some families just can't afford those higher costs. What about other park fees? Are other park fees increasing as well?
Well, so right now, State Parks covers about 51% of its operational costs through fees. And those are parking fees, those are public use cabins, camping fees, commercial use fees, things like that. Nationally, the gold standard on that is around 60%. And so our goal is to work towards that 60% or more number. I like to think I'm a little bit more creative than just raising rates across the board. So I think that there are some ways that we can get there. One of those ways is, the short answer is for parking fees and some of the basic fees, I don't have any plans on raising a lot of those rates across the board immediately. We have some other ways that we're looking at. So one of those is electronic fee stations, a lovely term, voluntary compliance. Mm-hmm. And I think we've all shown up at a state park and reached in our wallet and had a 20 or had no cash. I mean, everybody carries plastic and no one really carries cash anymore. And so implementing some of these new electronic fee stations can actually increase your parking revenue and this voluntary compliance by, you know, 20 to 40%, depending on, you know, what area you're talking about.
Sure.
So we do have some funds from this last budget cycle to deploy some of those new electronic fee stations. And so that's one of the methods in which we're looking to increase some of our revenue.
Well, and speaking of the last funding cycle, how deep have funding cuts been for state parks?
Well, this funding cycle, or this last budget cycle, was flat. By and large, it was flat for state parks. So we don't have any staff reductions this year, which is great. And we did get two capital appropriations, one for those electronic fee stations, and then the other one for five new public use cabins. And since we're so wily and quick on our feet, I think that we can likely leverage the money that we got for five new public use cabins and leverage that with some other funding sources that we potentially have and you know, maybe get more like 7 or 10 of those.
How does Alaska's fees, state park fee system compare with other states? And is there sort of like a sweet spot where you're getting closer to that 60% mark that you discussed without hindering access? What's known about that?
Yeah, and you hear me talk a lot about kind of the business development side of parks and fees and electronic fee stations and things like that. What I don't talk about but is really always in the back of my mind is access, because the purpose of these areas is for people to get out in them. Mm-hmm. And if you're raising fees on folks that can't afford them, then what you're doing is limiting access. So in the back of my mind, you know, any decision that we're making that has to do with fees, I always have this thought in the back of my mind that, you know, we need to make sure that we're not limiting access. And so I will say other states' fees are by and large quite a bit more.
Oh, okay.
than what ours are. And you know, another way that we're generating some additional revenue is there are spots in the state that don't have fee stations and should. And so over the last year or so that we've been expanding where we're able to charge fees. And so so that's another way that that we've been doing that. But yeah, by and large, other state parks, their fees are typically a bit higher than ours are. And they're quite a ways further down the road as far as the digital age. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of the fact that we only have in Alaska state parks right now, we only have two electronic fee stations. And that baffles folks in the lower 48, other state parks directors, where they're almost all electronic fee stations.
Aaron, you, excuse me, as we've been discussing, you spend a lot of time in these parks and correspond with people who come to your website and interact with the trips that you describe. What do you think about the fee structure? Are they reasonable?
So I actually do think that they are reasonable. I think what, and Ethan alluded to this, what gets a little confusing is the why are some a different cost than others? And, you know, he and I have talked about the potential for maybe structuring things a little bit more expensive during our higher season and then lowering that cost during the, and I don't even like to say off season because Alaska has no off season. We have four great seasons. But I think attracting people to these places during lower traffic times may actually help get more people into our parks. And accessibility is really important for me as well, not just from a cost standpoint, but for just putting the information out that people need to go visit these. So I think right now the fee structure is just a little confusing, but I think appropriate overall cost-wise.
All right, let's go to the phones. Martin is in Fairbanks. Hi.
Hi. I seem to recall in years past encountering camp hosts at certain campgrounds, and I even thought of looking into it myself. I'm retired. That might be a fun way to spend the summer, but I didn't follow through. But at some point, I thought I heard that the state was having trouble finding camp hosts. Does that program still exist, and is there a way to become part of that?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So we do have a volunteer host program, both in our campgrounds and in some of our more popular hiking areas and that sort of thing. We would love to have you. You can find out more information on that at our website, which is alaskastateparks.org. And it's always a challenge to find enough people to fill those roles. Our regional staff and our Anchorage staff work really hard to get good people in those roles. But it is always a challenge to find enough people to staff the different campsites and parking areas around the state.
What do they do? What does this kind of host family do?
They do so
much. It's a hard
much.
Job.
Yeah.
Really? Yes.
Yeah, I don't know. You might want to go back to retirement after after you try this. It's hard work. So they assist our area rangers and our area maintenance folks in upkeep of the park. They interact with the guests. They make sure people are paying their fees. Whenever there's a conflict as far as, you know, I'm supposed to be in spot 9. I had my stuff there while he moved it and parked his rig there. They have to kind of resolve those or, you know.
Refereeing.
There's a little bit of refereeing involved. It is really rewarding. It's really fun. But I don't think that the majority of the time is spent on the veranda sipping cocktails.
But you do get a free place to camp, right?
You do. You absolutely do.
There is some perks there. Let's stay with the phones for a moment. Mike is in Petersburg. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. It's encouraging to hear your show this morning. I've lived in Petersburg in Southeast Alaska for 77 years, and unfortunately, I've seen the destruction of many, many cabins. If the Department of Agriculture or the U.S. Forest Service has their way, they're going to destroy every cabin in the Tongass that's been permitted in one generation. And they've already destroyed, in our area, at least a dozen cabins that I can think of. So it's very encouraging to hear what you're saying about the Park Service and the cabins that are made available to my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren. The other thing that's disturbing is that our Forest Service is saying that the cabins that they do have, they can't really afford to keep up. And I actually flew out to, chartered a plane and flew out to Thomas Bay to a place called the Boar Lake and watched them destroy a Forest Service cabin there because they said it was in poor maintenance, which it actually wasn't. I took several pictures. But could you tell me in Southeast how many of these cabins you have available? The Park Service cabins?
Well, let's clarify first the distinction here. We're talking about state parks, and I think you're bringing national parks into this conversation. But Aaron, did you want to respond?
Yeah, well, I think so the Forest Service in the Tongass operates many, many, many public use cabins. So that is U.S. Department of Agriculture Forest Service. So we have two forests here in Alaska. We have Chugach National Forest, and then we have Tongass National Forest. And so I think that's what the caller is referring to. But, you know, the only thing I'd like to comment on is that for sure, especially down in Southeast, some cabins and locations are so remote, it's very hard for anybody to keep up with them. So I think what Ethan and I are talking about today with state parks is let's educate people and let's inform people. And then, you know, they can go beyond into the national systems that we have as well.
And I would say any plans that we have for new public use cabins in the state system are, you know, I mentioned we need to make sure that they're bringing in some level of revenue. And in order for them to bring in that revenue, they need to be accessible. And so they'll be either, you know, on the road system or they'll be shorter hikes or, you know, more mainstream. So maintenance won't be onerous.
All right. We are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk with Ranger Ben. Ranger Ben Schrock is the chief ranger for the Kodiak area, so we'll have him to add to the conversation about Alaska's awesome state park system as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We are discussing Alaska's state park system today. And the in-studio guests are Ethan Tyler, who is the director of the State Division of Parks and Recreation, and Aaron Kirkland, who is a travel writer based in Anchorage and spends a lot of time in the state parks. On the phone right now, we have Ranger Ben Schrock, who is the chief ranger for the Kodiak area. Hello.
Hey, good morning.
Thanks so much for being with us. Ben, describe the parks that you oversee in the Kodiak area.
Sure. So I'll tell you a little bit about them. One of our parks that sees the most visitors is the Fort Abercrombie State Historical Park, right outside of the city of Kodiak. And so the park here is, you know, important locally because it has a really kind of a extensive trail system that really provides a lot of access to wildlife viewing, very great scenery, and a lot of history. And one of the things that's neat about it is the spruce forest being so dense, even if there's 20 cars in the parking lot, you may not see another person your whole hike here. Mm. So kind of a neat park.
And how popular are the parks? Are the visitors that you see mostly Kodiak residents, or do you get a lot of tourists from other parts of Alaska and outside?
Yeah, great question. Definitely a big mix. We have, you know, the park is definitely used by a lot of locals on a daily basis, but a cruise ship sometimes bring in, you know, several hundred people in a day. So we'll see those, you know, tourists as well. And people like to bring friends or family in town here as well.
So, Ben, if someone from outside of Kodiak wants a trip, wants to plan a visit to one of Kodiak's state parks, what would you recommend? How should they go about that?
Sure. So, you know, it depends very much on what kinds of things you're interested in. But, you know, there's also the option to, you know, see several of those things, which I would recommend. So if you're someone that, you know, really enjoys history and likes to hike but doesn't want to hike difficult trails or wants to hike trails that someone, you know, maybe little kids in the family that can't do difficult trails, the Abercrombie is really a great option for those people to get to see some scenery. We've got, you know, great whale viewing from here in the summertime. Very neat historical bunkers with, you know, interpretive panels that tell you about the World War II history here. And on weekends in the summer, the Kodiak Military History Museum, which is at Miller Point in Fort Abercrombie, is open in the afternoons. So pretty neat. For people that are interested in fishing, the two best salmon runs on the Kodiak Road system are the two biggest for red salmon and silvers. The Buskin River and the Passagshack River are both in state recreation sites. And they're, you know, seeing red salmon runs mid-June through July, and then silver salmon runs August through October. And then for people that are even more adventurous or interested in, you know, getting really far out, we have Fognak Island State Park and Shuyak Island State Park, which have cabins and access for hunting and fishing.
That's fantastic. What a great rundown. And Erin has been nodding her head here in the studio. Erin, you've spent time at Kodiak Parks. Do you have anything to add to what Ben was saying?
And Erin and I were fortunate enough to spend some time with Ranger Ben last fall. We were both in Kodiak for a convention. And so Ranger Ben walked around Abercrombie with both of us and really opened our eyes to how cool of a spot it really is.
It's amazing. And I think what is so unique about Fort Abercrombie is that where a lot of Alaska state parks are kind of stopovers to other activities, Fort Abercrombie is a destination in itself. And not just because, you know, Ben talked about all the great things that you can do there. The Military Museum is just an absolutely outstanding example of what was going on Kodiak Island during World War II. And I highly recommend anyone who goes to Kodiak goes to this museum. These folks are amazing. And then you have the gun emplacements and the bunkers, and the park system has done a fabulous job of making it very accessible for everybody. And then you also have beach access, which is awesome for kids. So there's a little bit of everything right there. And it's not huge, but it's absolutely a place that, and you could pitch a tent, right?
Yep.
Take a little campground there. So it's one of my favorite things to do when we go to Kodiak.
That's fantastic. And Ben, what would you say is the hardest part about managing parks off the road system?
Yeah, you know, there's lots of challenges. And part of it is, you know, determining, you know, what kind of resources. Well, obviously everyone is, you know, limited in resources, and particularly the state sometimes. But we do our best to balance, you know, the amount of time we can put into maintaining and improving, you know, the parks and access to the parks and the facilities we have in them. And yeah, the remote areas can be particularly difficult because it's, you know, expensive and takes time to get to those areas. And you know, you can't bring a pickup truck, you know, with a bed full of tools with you. So oftentimes you get out to some place and you're, you know, working on a remote cabin or a remote trail and realize you don't have, you know, the equipment or whatever it is that you need to accomplish the task you're trying to do, or you've found some new problem. And you definitely just have to come up with the best solution you can and plan ahead for next time, and definitely a learning experience.
Mm-hmm. And Ben, so many people have heard of the legendary Kodiak brown bears. Is that a challenge or a problem in the parks?
Yeah, you know, we definitely work to reduce bear conflicts, you know, as much as we can. And last summer, we got some new signs to put up in the Buscombe River State Recreation Site because we were having some bear-human conflicts. And we did a lot of education, and we seemed to see some turnaround and some change in the way people were fishing and the precautions they were taking. And it is definitely, you know, kind of an ongoing challenge to kind of balance human safety and keep the bears around, but not.
Not too close.
Yeah.
They're so big and so scary. They don't want them too close. Ethan, you wanted to jump in here?
Yeah, I just, anytime that I'm able to have one of our rangers be part of these conversations, I want to do that because they're amazing folks. And they're law enforcement agents, so so they carry a sidearm and they wear a flak jacket, but they fix snow machines. They do search and rescues. Our ranger in Woodtickchick is a pilot. They clean restrooms. Mm-hmm. They are the face of our state parks. Often one of the first contacts people make. And they do this amazing, and like, you know, Ranger Ben is saying that, you know, he works a lot with bear and human interactions, and they do this amazing job of balancing everything that they have on their plates. And I'm really proud to work with them, and I'm really, they're such great people, and I always want to take the opportunity to offer my thanks to them for the work that they do.
All right. Well, there you go, Ben. Big props to you for a good job out on Kodiak. And we're going to go to the phones. We've got a lot of callers stacked up. So let's get to a few phone calls here. Brenda is in Deering, and we were just talking about bears and parks, and Brenda has a question or a comment about animals and cabins. Hi, Brenda.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was just wondering what happens when the animals, like, trash a cabin, and who takes care of that? And I'll listen to your answer on the radio. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Brenda. Yeah, what I imagine that does happen sometimes. Maybe those big brown bears on Kodiak or other places create some mischief, or raccoons, or name the critter.
Yeah, so we definitely do have occasionally bears will, you know, tear off a door to something or break a window. What we'll do is, you know, when we find out about it, we'll try and get out there and, you know, fix it as best we can, as soon as we can. But then what we try to do is we try to provide good information and education on what people should do and not do at cabins to help prevent that from happening. So some things that we recommend here locally in Kodiak for our state parks cabins is we have wood sheds, but we don't have doors on them. We ask that people not store deer or other game in those sheds. Same thing with the inside of the cabin is, you know, you don't really want to process your deer in there, one, because it would make, you know, the cabin smell bad and would attract bears to want to come inside the cabin. But we recommend hanging game from trees. And,
sure.
Yeah, it's sort of the best way to do that is in between trees. But we also ask that, you know, people are sometimes overly generous and think, you know, if they leave some food behind, then maybe some hungry person will be helped. But the reality is that, you know, bears have very, you know, powerful olfactory senses. They can smell very well. And if we leave, you know, food in our public use cabins, the bears may get hungry, smell that there's food in there, break in, and you know, it hasn't happened here with anyone in a cabin before, but that would be, you know, pretty dangerous if a bear became accustomed to breaking into cabins and, you know,
right,
ended up breaking in with someone in there. So we recommend, and we always throw out any food when we get out there to maintain the service cabins.
And that's just basic common sense about any camping protocol, is not having food in your tent or in the cabin. You just don't want anything from the very large to the very small animal-wise to come creeping in at night when you're trying
yep.
to sleep. So thanks so much for that information, Ben. And we're going to stick with the phones here for a little bit and go to Kim in Palmer. Hi, Kim.
Good morning. I have been hiking up at Hatcher Pass for the last 33 years, and I buy the annual state park parking pass. And every year, including June and July of last year, I was able to use my parking pass anywhere in the Hatcher Pass area. And then I went up last August, and the man stopped me at the booth going up to Independence Mine. I like to hike the Gold Cord Trail, and said that pass was not valid there. And then he said something rather odd. He said, and it never has been. And yet I'd been using it for 33 years. So I wonder, has something changed in terms of the state parking pass permit up at the Independence Mine?
All right. Well, thanks. Great question, Kim.
That is a really good question, Kim. So last year, and it was right around the turn of the fiscal year in July, but last year we did institute a historical access fee for Independence Mine specifically. And so one of the things that's maybe a misnomer is we don't charge for access in our park areas. So like if you go up to Glen Alps, you pay a parking fee, but you don't pay an access fee. So we don't charge to access the parks. But we are starting to charge for historical sites and access to some of the different historical sites that we manage, Independence Mine being one of those. So that is the difference in that fee structure, and that parking pass is not valid for access to Independence Mine. But if if you like, right at that booth down there, you can, there's a parking area down there. Your parking pass is valid at that historical access fee booth. And then you, I think it's like a half a mile, you can walk up to Independence Mine proper. And so that parking pass is valid there, but beyond that, it's a historical access fee.
So then you need a separate permit of some type, or you just have to pay an access fee?
We're looking at potential permits for historical access fees because we recognize that there are locals who love to go up there and go time after time after time. And, you know, paying a $3 per person fee could feel onerous for that. So we are working on a historical access pass. But in the meantime, you do have to pay the per-person fee to access that site.
Is the reasoning for this fee for historical sites because they need a little more oversight? You have to watch things a little more closely in those areas?
Yeah, it costs. I mean, we are looking at creative ways to generate additional revenues. And it does cost money to manage that that historical site. It turns out that, you know, old buildings fall down over time.
Yeah.
And, you know, maintaining that and keeping it in a condition that warrants, you know, people wanting to visit it is a bit more expensive.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, more questions, more callers, and more information about our great state park system on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at Matson.com.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Let's go to the phones again. Kevin is in Anchorage. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. See, sure. I have a question for Erin. Based on her experience traveling around, are there alternatives to public use cabins? I know they fill up so fast. Alternatives to, you know, the public use cabins, you know, here in South Central that people might consider.
Hi, Kevin. Thank you. Yes, there actually are some options for folks. So if the public use cabins that you want to visit are full, or if you just like a different option, there is an option through the Alaska Huts Association. They have a Manitoba cabin that they operate at mile 48 of the Seward Highway, and it's a historic mining homestead, and it's about a 20-minute walk in from the Seward Highway, and it's a pretty spectacular place to be hanging out. There's two yurts and a cabin. And, so about 16 to 18 people can be put up there overnight. You can rent a bunk or you can rent the whole facility, whichever you'd like to do. So that's also a nice option. And I think the future of cabins and huts in Alaska is really going to start to change a little bit because we are finding that these are so popular.
All right. Well, thanks so much for the call, Kevin. Let's go to Homer now. Robert is in Homer. Hi.
Good morning. Thanks, Ethan and Erin and yourself for putting this show on. I just wanted to give a little chat about Kachemak Bay State Park in the wilderness area down here. I'm part of the Kachemak Bay, Friends of Kachemak Bay, and organization to help with the park and maintain campgrounds and trails over there. And I just wanted to shout out for Friends of State Parks. It's a great volunteer opportunity. That and the water trail down here, we've adopted three campgrounds to help state parks, and Jason O'Cooley, the ranger down here, does a great job with his limited funding and personnel, but it's a big important aspect to that, and some great trails down here. The Friends of Kachemak Bay State Park posts the trail conditions on their website and on Facebook, so it's Kachemak Bay State Park. .org.
All right.
Or catch. Yep.
Well, thanks.
And, and the water trail has a website also. So that's catchmacbaywatertrails.com. And they have lots of information about the bay. And we want to see y'all have a good time.
Well, Robert, thanks so much. Your call was perfect as a lead into the next question. It was almost as if you were on cue. So thanks so much for the call because I wanted to get to that question about. You know, up against budget cuts and continuing financial restraints, there are these organizations that are volunteers. And we had an email question about the Chugach Park Fund established through the Alaska Community Foundation. So talk a little bit about that, Ethan, about friends of parks in these groups, such as Robert mentioned, and this question we had about Chugach. How important is this, and what do they do? How does this work?
Yeah, so the friends groups around the state, and there are a number of them, are about as diverse as the state is. Some are really, really active. Some are a little bit less active. But they all are a really important conduit to the community. And Robert, thank you for your service on the Ketchmack Bay, Friends of Ketchmack Bay State Park. They really support the state park operations. They're really critical in, you know, they help raise funds for equipment that we may need and might not be able to afford right at that moment in time. And you know, we were talking about Independence Mine before. There's a Matsu Friends of Matsu State Parks group that just bought an Argo for the Denali State Park ranger and his staff.
Great.
And so they help fill in. Not only do they help fill in the gaps from a monetary standpoint, but they also they really provide a great advocacy for and exposure for parks, you know, trying to get people out into them.
Free advertising.
Yeah, having a face to these parks and really having citizen users of parks as ambassadors is priceless, and we couldn't do what we do without the friends groups.
Hooray for volunteers. Let's go to Cliff in Kasilof. Hi, Cliff.
Good morning. I appreciate having the opportunity to be a guest on your show. I was started with state parks in 1976 as a seasonal, and ended my career short. Took early retirement in 92, but I've been working seasonally and volunteering ever since in the marine park. So I wanted to point out that the Friends of State Parks, the Sierra Clubs, the Air Corps, the AvTech, all the hosts and people that do volunteer and share in the logistics, because it's a logistical challenge Alaska is, and of course the marine parks are even more so. And one of my questions for Ethan was about corrections. How are they involved, or can they be involved, or is that a political thing or a legality thing that they haven't been bringing more corrections resources into maintenance and providing resources for state parks?
Interesting question, Cliff. Ethan.
Yeah, I'm always quick to admit when I don't know something, and so I'll jump right on that and say I don't know. It's an interesting idea, and mm-hmm. Certainly something. You've piqued my interest, so yeah. It's certainly something we can look into for sure.
Well, thanks for that, Cliff, and it's kind of an interesting lead into another question that we had by email that is from Tom in Fairbanks, who says, nationally, minority and low-income families visit national park sites much less than others. I assume that's true in Alaska, he says. Are the state parks working with local Native organizations to increase participation? The National Park System has signed an agreement with a Tlingit organization in Sitka. What about the state parks, Ethan?
So we do work with Native organizations throughout the state. I personally think we could do more, and one of my goals is to incorporate that a little bit more. You know, one of our sections in state parks is the interpretation and education section, and so all those signs that you see on the roadside and in our parks, those are created by a team that lives within the division, and they always reach out. They're always reaching out to, you know, to the area Native groups to gather information and to fact check, and they've always been really helpful in that. I think taking it a step further and encouraging, you know, more visitation or, you know, volunteerism or things like that. There's a great example, I won't go too far into it, but there's a great example in the Yukon Territory in Carcross, where they've First Nation kids have been building mostly mountain bike trails on First Nation land, but working with some park folks there. And it's been really successful because it's giving these kids, it's keeping them out of trouble, for one, but it's also giving them, you know, something that they take pride in their work. They're being taught a skill, and you know, they work with some at-risk youth as well. And so maybe not exactly like that, or maybe not exactly with that outcome, but definitely casting a broader net for things like that is something that I'm certainly really interested in.
All right, let's talk just briefly in our last couple of minutes here about managing popular parks. Glen Alps here is like the most popular in the state. What are the big challenges there? Is it mostly parking, or are there other things that you're dealing with, other conflicts?
Yeah, I mean, when you boil it down, I mean, a lot of it does come down to parking, but just the immense popularity of that particular site. So the number one, this is always a great stat that I love to throw out, the number one viewed web page on alaskastateparks.org is the Glen Alps webcam. And it's people checking on parking, basically. Sure. And so, you know, there are a number of access issues that come with that. We want to be good neighbors to the people that live up there. So, you know, we work closely with the municipality, and they've been really helpful in putting up no parking signs, and mitigating that. And then, you know, I'll go back to our volunteer hosts. We have a host up at the Glen Alps parking area that can mitigate some of that. We have rangers up there as well. So it's one of the most popular, if not the most popular, trailhead in the state. And we're limited on the facilities and the space that we have up there. So definitely access challenges for sure.
Aaron, let's get you in here in this final minute. What's your take on why Glen Alps is so popular? And do you think that there are other local parks that should be more popular?
Absolutely. And Ethan and I have talked about this. I think, for one, Glen Alps is popular just because it's the one that everybody's most familiar with. So I think a real drive, and this is part of what I try to do and work closely with Ethan on, is putting information out of the other options. What are the other options? Because if we don't know, we're just going to go to the place that we do know. So sharing other, you know, easily accessible options for people is going to be, you know, definitely something I think we need to look at. But it's also the place that we get great views, and we get, you know, we can see wildlife there and things like that. So, you know, I think there are some things that the parks could be doing. You know, maybe a shuttle would be a cool thing to have from downtown on a regular basis. I know other state parks have done that. But I think really it's information that we need to be sharing with people. There's amazing resources out there, and there's amazing places, so we should be using them.
All right. Well, thank you so much. This was such a fun conversation. We, of course, didn't get to all the calls or all the emails, but thanks so much to my guests today, Ethan Tyler, who is the director of the State Division of Parks and Recreation, and also Aaron Kirkland, who is a travel writer based in Anchorage who spends a lot of time in state parks. Thanks to all of you for listening to our discussion today on the state park system, and also to Ranger Ben Schrock, who is in the Kodiak area and joined us earlier. Next week, we'll be back. Ann Hillman will be hosting a discussion on foster care in the state and some of the changes that have happened in the state. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. This program is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400. This is Alaska Public Media.